Monday, June 15th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Coming up, President Obama has to wait for negotiating authority to complete a potentially historic trade deal.
The obligations are very much still in place, and that South Africa does have an obligation to arrest and hand President Bashir over.
Will a president wanted by the International Criminal Court be arrested while he travels? Egypt says its new Suez Canal is about to open in a few weeks. Music that could help power a part of the world currently without electricity. It's all coming up on today's International Edition. President Barack Obama is seeking approval from the U.S. Congress for authority to negotiate two huge trade deals, especially one involving several nations in Asia. Congress, and Mr. Obama's party in particular, voted down the proposed authority on Friday. It's a big setback for the president, for now. So we turn to VOA Senate correspondent Michael Bowman, who's been watching the political maneuvering. And Michael, the Trade Promotion Authority bill was defeated despite a rare visit by President Obama to Capitol Hill to try to cement support.
He made this personal effort, this pilgrimage to the Hill, specifically targeting House Democrats, members of his own party. And he wanted those House Democrats to not just vote for trade promotion authority, which allows up or down votes on trade bills. It's called, also known as fast track, since it facilitates the approval because Congress can't amend the bill. It's simply an up or down vote. But there was also another provision that had to do with retraining American workers who might be impacted by trade, who might lose their jobs as a result of international competition. And this is where it gets confusing because House Democrats voted down that worker assistance, even though they are very much in favor of it. The only reason that they did that is because it proved to be a huge fly in the ointment as far as getting fast track approved. And this is where Congress gets complicated. The Senate passed fast track authority, but they also passed this worker retraining bill. And the way that Congress works, unless the House and the Senate pass identical versions of the bill, it's all for nothing. So House Democrats knew that even though they supported this worker retraining bill, if they voted against it, that it would stop fast track dead in its tracks. And so you had House Democrats meeting with the president, a man that they have, followed into battle on numerous occasions, and a man that they truly revere and admire and are normally on the same page with. But this time they came out of that meeting and voted exactly as the president did not want them to vote. As of right now, fast track is in limbo, which means that two major deals, trade deals, pending trade deals that the Obama administration has been negotiating for years, spanning the Atlantic between the United States and the European Union and the Pacific, a 12-nation trans-Pacific partnership, these are all in limbo because without fast track, there is no real way to get them through Congress intact.
To the casual observer, it's rather interesting to see that President Obama had wide-ranging support from the Republicans on this issue.
Interesting bedfellows.
strange times.
Strange times.
You get strange bedfellows.
On any given day of the week, on any given issue, Republicans line up exactly opposed to President Obama on any issue you could point to, except for this. This is one occasion where the administration is bucking that traditional dogma and saying, look, we are negotiating in a new way. We are going to have all those worker protections. We're going to protect the environment, and we're going to do this in a way that Democrats can feel good about. But the White House is sounding, at least publicly, is sounding optimistic.
And I'm sure there's a lot of backroom negotiations going on so that when it comes around again, perhaps they'll be ready to push it through.
Indeed. And you can imagine all the different pressure groups and interest groups remaining on high alert. I mean, if you are a member of America's labor movement or if you are an environmentalist, you are on high alert right now, reaching out to those House Democrats, telling them to stand strong, not to change their vote. If you're a member of the Chamber of Commerce or you work for the administration, then you are reaching out to them and asking, please, sir or madam, would you mind switching your vote so we can get this done?
One of the many things that keeps Congress interesting for us to watch. And our Senate Superman, Michael Bowman, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Jim.
Well, while Trade Authority has not landed on Mr. Obama's desk, it is time for perhaps a space probe to land on something out in space. Really exciting. We check in social media with Michael Lippin, who's here in the studio, Hi, Michael. It's a groundbreaking space mission, and it appeared to have been lost for a while. Now it's back in business.
Yes, something has definitely landed. That space mission by the European Space Agency made headlines last November when it became the first in history to successfully land on a comet. The washing machine-sized lander called Philae settled on Comet 67P and transmitted data to Earth for only about 60 hours before switching off when its battery ran out of power. It had rather unluckily landed on a spot that was blocked from the sunlight that it needed to recharge its solar-powered batteries. But the scientists behind the mission never gave up hope that as the comet moved closer to the sun, Philae could someday be exposed to the sun's rays and wake up from its slumber. Well, the world found out earlier today that Philae had in fact woken up when its Twitter account sent out this message: "Hello, Earth. Can you hear me? Hashtag wake up Philae."
Wow, a space lander with its own Twitter account.
Yes, it is a thing. Not only that, but its Twitter handle at Philae 2014 is being followed by 409,000 people. Mm. Not bad for a space vehicle, huh?
No.
Its first tweet since last November has been retweeted at least 25,000 times, so it does have a pretty active following. The folks behind the mission's social media presence were in a pretty playful mood today after the news broke. They also operate a Twitter account for Rosetta, a spacecraft that sent Philae to the comet and has been orbiting the comet ever since. Its account at ESA_Rosetta has 324,000 followers, and it got into a cute little conversation with Philae, and it went something like this. Philae tweeted, "Hello, Rosetta, I'm awake. How long have I been asleep? Hashtag life on a comet." Rosetta responded, "Hello, Philae, you've had a long sleep, about 7 months." Now, if you go to Rosetta's Twitter page, you can also see an artist's impression of Philae waking up. Okay, it's actually a little cartoon of Philae stretching out its arms and having a yawn, but, you know, why not?
Why not? So what's next for Philae, Michael?
Well, the scientists say Philae's first transmission sent data to Earth for 85 seconds. They're now waiting for the next transmissions to arrive, and in the meantime, they're planning to change Rosetta's orientation to point more directly at the lander so that communication between the two of them becomes easier. Jim?
Great. Thank you so much, Michael. Michael Lippin, following Philae, the comet lander, for us, and we'll hear more about that as the story progresses. Follow Michael on Twitter at Michael_Lippin. This is VOA.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
This week's African Union summit has been interrupted by drama over what to do with Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, whose arrival at the Johannesburg summit could compel South Africa to arrest him on an international war crimes warrant. VOA's Anita Powell has more from the summit on the sidelines in Johannesburg.
Sudan's president looked relaxed and confident as he lined up with other African heads of state for a group picture at the AU summit. But around him, a firestorm is brewing. President Omar al-Bashir is the target of an arrest warrant by the International Criminal Court. He has been indicted for crimes against humanity and genocide in the western Darfur region of Sudan. South Africa is a member state of the International Court, and so, legal experts argue, the nation is obliged to arrest him. Institute of Security Studies Managing Director Anton du Plessis says he agrees with the prominent South African and international groups that have demanded Mr. Bashir's arrest.
The South African government is arguing that the immunity provisions or agreements that it has with the AU means that it does not need to comply with its obligations under the Rome Statute and the Security Council to arrest him. Our view on that is that it's incorrect and that, in fact, the obligations are very much still in place and that South Africa does have an obligation to arrest and hand President Bashir over. That is also the opinion of the International Criminal Court, which last night the pretrial chamber issued a very clear order which clarified this position.
But there were no manacles on the president as he lined up and chatted with South African President Jacob Zuma and Zimbabwean President Robert Mugabe. Instead, Mr. Bashir stood in the front row of the group photo, smiled, and flashed a thumbs-up sign. Mr. Bashir's situation is far from stable. On Sunday, a South African court issued an urgent interdiction to bar him from leaving South Africa until the court hears the appeal calling for his arrest. But it is not clear how that will be enforced. The Sudanese president reportedly entered, like many other African heads of state here for the summit, on an official plane that landed at a South African Air Force base in the capital, Pretoria. South Africa's president previously said in 2009 that he will call for Mr. Bashir's arrest if he enters South Africa. Du Plessis says this affair reflects badly on South Africa.
What it does say about South Africa is that even though our government has taken a particular position on this, we still have a very robust civil society, we still have a very independent judiciary, and I hope that by the end of this, the message will be clear that you can't be alleged of committing these crimes and just come to South Africa and no one says anything.
The African Union has previously argued the court is biased against African nations. Author David Hoyle says he agrees with this position.
What the AU should do, certainly en masse or bilaterally, is actually leave the ICC. It's a dysfunctional court. It's not working properly. And I think it's irretrievably flawed. With regards to what South Africa should do, again, I think it's actually pretty clear. In terms of the UN Vienna Convention on Diplomatic Immunity, any sitting head of state has sovereign immunity.
Mr. Bashir appears to be in that situation within the plush halls of the AU summit. But what happens once he leaves these doors is anyone's guess. Anita Powell, VOA News, Johannesburg.
You can follow more on this story at our website. It's voanews.com. This is VOA's International Edition. Egyptian authorities say they are on track to open a new Suez Canal on August 6th. It's a project they say will more than double the canal's income during the next 10 years. But as VOA's Heather Murdoch reports from Egypt, some analysts say that the project alone will not be enough to rescue the country's failing economy.
Authorities say Egyptian President Abdel Fattah el-Sisi plans to announce the new Suez Canal is open for business on August 6th. At that time, they say, ships around the world will blast their horns in recognition of the event. Suez Canal Authority head Admiral Mohab Mohammed Hussein Mamish says the project will cut the amount of time it takes to travel through the canal in half, lowering costs for shippers. The Suez Canal is a major shipping route connecting Europe and Asia and brought in $5.5 billion last year. The new canal is an expansion of the current canal that will allow ships to pass by each other like a two-lane highway as opposed to a single lane.
(laughs)
Less than 10 years from now, says Mamish, the expanded canal will earn $13 billion a year for Egypt. But naval history professor Andrew Lambert of King's College in London says the canal's success will depend largely on the global shipping industry, which Egypt cannot control. Even if it is successful, he adds, he does not think it will be enough to improve the lives of average Egyptians who are suffering rising poverty and prices as the economy tries to recover from the financial and political turmoil between 2011 and 2013.
That's a high-risk strategy, and Egypt is a large, complex country with a very big population. It's highly unlikely it's going to be able to live off the kinds of incomes it will get even from two canals. The costs of governing Egypt are very large. There's major debt problems.
But authorities say the economy is growing and the canal is one of many projects intended to boost foreign investment and generate income. From a boat meandering by construction sites on the new canal Sunday, giant waterspouts are seen slowly raising the level of the waterway. The boat is provided by the Suez Canal Authority to promote the project. Reporters snap pictures while workers drop hints about who may be attending the opening bash. Kings and presidents for certain, along with hundreds of celebrities. The project was scheduled to take a year, but a year ago, analysts balked at the possibility that it could be finished so fast. And while no ship horns are blowing yet, Egyptian officials are confident that they will be blowing soon. Heather Murdoch, VOA News, Ismailia, Egypt.
You're listening to International Edition. This is VOA.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artist. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Music tends to light the spirits and imaginations of most people who listen, and now there's the potential for music to literally light up a part of the world as our own David Byrd and Ray McDonald get together in the studio.
You might know Senegalese-American musician and producer Akon for his song Beautiful, but you didn't know that he is part of a group that wants to bring electric power to 600 million people in Africa. To find out more, Ray McDonald joins me in the studio. Ray, this is a huge undertaking for a pop star, a musician.
Yeah, it is. And it just riveted my attention when I first read about it a couple weeks ago. Now, Akon last released an album in 2008, but he has been busy. He's working on something he calls Lighting Africa. Now, it's a two-year-old project with a billion-dollar credit line. He's working with two partners, and he hopes to provide 600 million Africans with energy from the sun.
Now, its first project, as I understand, is the launch of a solar academy in Mali to train people to work with this initiative?
The Solar Academy in Bamako, Mali, is slated to begin this North American summer. And on Wednesday, Akon told a UN news conference that Lighting Africa has now spread to 14 countries in Saharan and sub-Saharan Africa. So he is really working hard to get this project off the ground.
And providing light to these people or energy to these people not only benefits them by allowing them to have electricity, but also kids can study at home and people can work later. It helps them economically too, right?
Well, Akon says one of the big objectives of Lighting Africa is to take advantage of the continent's human capital. Many parts of Africa get more than 300 days of sun a year, and 70% of the continent's population is under 35. Akon wants to put them to work in building this solar infrastructure and maintaining it.
All right, that's VOA's Ray McDonald. We'd love to hear your opinion on this. You can log on to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/Voice of America. If you're on Twitter, you can also hit up Ray McDonald at @VOA_music, or Ray, your Twitter handle for your personal account?
Ray on the Hits.
You can also listen for Ray on VOA 1 if you like to listen to music, and you can also hear him do the top 20 and the top 5 countdowns every week.
When I see
listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. You can find us on the internet. Our website is voanews.com. Our Facebook page is VOA Asia. We hope you stop by when you have a chance. We're also on Twitter as well. We come to you each and every day from Washington. We hope you enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The fight against ISIL will be long, but if the coalition remains united, determined, and focused, it will ultimately succeed, said U.S. Undersecretary of State Antony Blinken. Some gains have been achieved in the last 9 months since the coalition has come together. ISIL now controls 25% less territory in Iraq than it did when the fighting first started, and ISIL has lost significant numbers of men and materiel. At the same time, the coalition partners acknowledge that ISIL remains resilient, ruthless, and capable of taking the initiative, as they did in the capture of Ramadi. We have to learn from and act on such setbacks, said Undersecretary Blinken. In Iraq right now, we have the right strategy, a combination of coalition airstrikes, training, equipping, assisting, and effective local partners. As for Iraq's part, Iraqi Prime Minister Haider Abadi has laid out an effective military and political action plan for his country. It calls for accelerating the training and equipping of local tribes in coordination with Anbar authorities, streamlining the provision of weapons, expanding recruitment into the Iraqi army, recalling and refitting the local police, supporting a development fund for stabilization to get immediate assistance to areas that are cleared of ISIL, and ensuring that all forces in Iraq act under Iraqi command, a critical element of the plan to ensure accountability and a unified approach in the fight against ISIL. One immediate step that the U.S. is taking is to ship anti-tank rockets for use against the kind of suicide vehicles that were deployed in Ramadi to such terrible effect. Also, the U.S. is doing all it can to aid the region's millions of refugees and displaced persons from both Syria and Iraq. The United States has provided $3.7 billion in humanitarian aid to those affected by the war in Syria. And since the start of fiscal year 2014, more than $407 million for displaced Iraqis. The U.S. and its coalition partners remain determined to defeat ISIL, ultimately creating a future of opportunity and peace for people in Iraq, in Syria, and indeed in the entire region.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.